For the first presentation, I'm happy to invite Dr. John Benzie to speak on promoting responsible use and conservation of aquatic biodiversity for aquaculture development. Let me first read you the brief CV of Dr. John Benzie. Dr. John Benzie, BS Honours Aberdeen, PhD Australian National University, has worked extensively for more than 25 years in government, university and private sectors worldwide, applying genetics to natural resource management and aquaculture. Professor Benzie led programs in aquaculture, biotechnology and marine science for Australian government agencies, the University of New South Wales, and a multinational shrimp breeding company. He is currently Professor of Marine Molecular Biodiversity at University College Cork, Ireland. So I think with that, I would like to invite Dr. John Benzie.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to talk today on promoting the responsible use and conservation of aquatic biodiversity for sustainable aquaculture development. And I will focus particularly on genetic aspects of that. Now, aquatic genetic resources provide a rich diversity of genetic material worldwide. And the question is, how can these be exploited sustainably and the wild resources protected? What genetic knowledge or technologies are available to aid sustainable production? Now, aquatic genetic resources in aquaculture are focused, of course, on the production, and the production we're interested in here is food, although there is a tremendous potential for use of these animals and plants for nutraceuticals and pharmaceuticals. So what I'll talk about today will focus first on production, as to how aquatic genetic resources have been used, what genetic technologies have been applied, what genetic changes occur in culture, and then once we've seen the sense of that material, what sort of impacts on wild resources might occur. Also, the recent experience and greater understanding of the wild genetic resources available from the application of genetics and evolutionary biology to understanding wild systems. The impacts then, as I've said before, of the production processes, and then what information there might be available to develop technologies and strategies for reducing this impact. Now, assuming that there needs to be a doubling of food production in the next 30 or 40 years, and that the bulk of that has to come from aquaculture because of a static fisheries production, then that would require a threefold increase in aquaculture production. Now, in the past 20 or 30 years, there's been a 10% annual growth in aquaculture, and that's been achieved by accessing new areas of production, farming new species, and through increasing efficiencies of production. And you can see here that the bulk of this process has actually happened in the last 30 or 40 years, which is a huge, hugely rapid process. Now, there's only two ways in which one could sustain further development. One is accessing new sites, but as has been said on many occasions in the last few days, there are increasing restrictions on aquaculture expansion. The picture on the left shows the Irish Sea and lists more than 20 different uses for that area, and with an indication of how those uses are spread spatially. Here in the Mediterranean, the blue areas indicate potential conservation areas. And in Scotland, you can see how some natural coastlines present themselves for aquaculture and other ones do not. So sites are finite, there's conflicts with other users, and while I have used marine examples here, this conflict, of course, is far, far greater in the freshwater area, and the bulk of aquaculture production comes from freshwater areas. So this demands that increases in production in aquaculture will be required through increasing efficiency, increasing the efficiency of husbandry processes, using the domestication process and genetic improvement in production systems. Now, it's worthwhile looking at agriculture for a moment, because when we look at the history of that, we see some patterns which emerge. And I will very briefly go through those. And these have been documented very well in a series of publications, both by Jared Diamond and by the FAO itself in terms of plant genetic resources and animal genetic resources. And the key points that emerge from this are that although species in agriculture have been developed in several parts of the world, there are actually relatively few centers of origin given in this, I guess it's red. I'm red-green colorblind, so I'll just point to it. So there's about 9 centers of origin in the world. But also, the centers of production today are not necessarily those areas. The centers of production are in very, very different places. So irrespective of where a species was developed or domesticated first, it is now produced in many places in the world, and the main centers of production can be elsewhere. Now, this process involved a rapid spread of species throughout the world. And in this case, I'm just showing you some examples from the Middle East, where there are, and I'll have to put my specs on there, where the centers of origin for pigs, cattle, goats, wild wheat, and so on were. Now, it's a fairly restricted geographical area. And the domestication process started something like 11 or 10,000 years ago for these species. But by 7,000 years ago, they'd spread right through Western Europe. Now, that may not sound like it's fast, but the point I'm making is that this spread did not happen in the last 200 or 300 years. This spread happened many, many thousands of years ago. So the spread is not a function of modern-day processes. It was something that went on anyway through exchange, trade, and travel of ancient peoples. Now, the application of genetic technologies to wild and cultured populations has shown us that animals and plants that had a restricted wild distribution normally had one domestication event. And those organisms that were domesticated first, or the stock that was domesticated first, spread widely enough, was exchanged widely enough before other attempts were made, or it replaced other events. Species with a broader wild distribution had several domestication events, such as horses and pigs. And where there were real barriers to dispersal of people, there was the domestication of several related species, as occurred in South America. Now, in an extensive analysis of these situations, Jared Diamond, principally, has demonstrated convincingly that those species which were domesticated not only had useful characters which people were interested in, but that those species were actually easy to domesticate. And that reason is why there's only a relatively few domesticated species in agriculture in the world. So I just give two rough examples here. So despite more than 200,000 higher plants occurring in the wild and many thousands of these being accessed by hunter-gatherers, there are only 100 major domesticated crops, and 5 of those are responsible for 90% of agriculture production. Again, large herbivores, 148 in the wild, less than 10% are major domesticated species, and relatively few of those give rise to 90% of production. And what about aquatic species? Well, you have the same process there. Something like 100,000 species in total of finfish, mollusks, crustaceans, and seaweeds. In each case, you can see that a relatively small number of those are cultured, although in aquaculture today there's roughly 350 to 400 species being cultured. But when you look at the production, there's only 76 species in total of these 360 which are responsible for 99% of the production. But if you look further and look at 80% of the production is achieved by only 21 of those. So the pattern is remarkably similar. There's a large genetic diversity in the wild. Relatively few of those organisms are cultured, and they're cultured because they've been relatively easy to culture. Not just the fact that they have characteristics of interest, it's been possible to grow them. and it's been relatively easy and sensible to grow them. But not only that, there's very few of them have been able to be used to produce the vast majority of aquaculture production. 6% out of all these organisms. We look also then at whether these species have moved around the planet. And the picture shows a situation for shrimp. And here you can see that shrimp from whose natural range has been the west coast of America have now spread right through not only South and North America, but there's a huge production now in Asia of Pinaeus vanimae. And you can think of a whole range of examples. So red claw, which occurs in a small region of Australia, has been exported to China and South America, where there are small but significant industries there, but no industry in Australia. And, of course, Atlantic salmon, having been developed in Norway, is now spread to new areas in South America, and so on. Of the 76 species used for major production today, all have been spread regionally, and the majority of them have been spread globally. In addition, of the 200 or more species which are responsible for 1% of the production, a great many of those have been spread around as well. Not only that, and we'll come to this in more detail later, but breeding programs are often developed far from the source area or even the major production areas. So what we're seeing here is a fairly complex mix of developmental processes. But the pattern is the same as has occurred in agriculture. So whatever processes are leading to that, there's a similarity despite the far faster growth of aquaculture. Now, of course, the spread of all these species has led to impact. And, of course, there is the concentrated impact of where a particular culture occurs. But the main concern that has arisen is the establishment of feral populations of alien species, the genetic exchange of aquaculture escapees with wild stocks, and the introgression, that is the exchange and uptake of genes which are adapted to the culture environment by wild stocks. And that's led to people suggesting that it might be more sensible to develop endemic species. And one of the principal points I'm going to make in the talk is, having seen the general pattern of aquaculture development follow that of agriculture, that may or may not be possible. There's a huge range of wild genetic diversity, but not many species are domesticable. So how realistic is it to simply say, well, let's develop endemic species? The other point I will make is an endemic species will be in the environment or close to the range of its wild populations with whom it will be able to breed and with whom escapees from aquaculture are likely to introduce genes which are more adapted to the culture environment. So there's a lot of things you do not solve by working simply with endemic species. So let's look at domestication in aquaculture. It's been recent and rapid, as all of you will be aware. And here in this graph produced by Duarte et al. About 3 or 4 years ago, you can see in the past the bulk of agriculture development the domestication process started about 10 or 11,000 years ago, was largely finished by about 4 or 5,000 years ago, and there were very, very few species domesticated since. When you look at the, because these are log scales, when you look at freshwater animals and freshwater and marine animals and plants, you can see that the process started for very few of them more than 1,000 years ago. The vast majority of this process has occurred in the last 100 years, and much of it in the last 20 or 30, as previous graphs have shown. Now, Duarte et al. Concluded that this rapid process was because aquatic species are easy to reproduce in culture. And he estimated that it took about 10 years of R&D to domesticate a species. I will dispute that considerably with data I'll show you later. Part of this difference in view is that domestication is more than closing the life cycle. And I think Duarte included a lot of material that where the life cycle was closed, but in my view, the animals or plants were still not what I would call domesticated. And Bilio raised this point about a year later, and he noted that reproduction from adults in culture, the adults reared in culture, responsible for producing young and doing that process for at least 3 years, would be a requisite for saying that an organism was domesticated. And I've used that definition in looking at the data that was available. Now, of course, I've said that there have been biological constraints to the development of agriculture species, and the same is absolutely true of aquaculture species. And this can be easily demonstrated by looking at the major production within each of the major taxonomic classes of cultured organisms. Let's just look at bivalves and gastropods. Almost all the production is from bivalves, and there's virtually none from gastropods. That's a function of the nature of the biology of these organisms and the way they're farmed. If you look at crustaceans, the bulk of the production is from marine shrimp. Those of you who work with crustaceans will know that they have, many of them, a larval phase. And the reason why many spiny lobsters are not farmed is that the larval phase lasts anywhere from 6 months to 2 years. And it's simply not technically feasible or economically feasible to farm them as yet. But it's unlikely to be so. So marine shrimp have a larval phase of about 2 to 3 weeks. And they've obviously been able to be domesticated, and they've been able to be produced in large numbers. Again, looking at the process for fish, very few marine fish, or very little overall production from marine fish, the vast majority comes from freshwater fish. So there are biological constraints to aquaculture domestication. I now want to look at the current status of domestication and genetic improvement in aquaculture. And the distinction I make between these two states is domestication I'm defining in the way that I described in a previous slide. And I differentiate domestication from genetic improvement in this way. Domestication is where you take an animal into culture, you breed them in culture, you may or may not direct that process very strongly. If you take an animal into culture, it will begin to change, whether you want it to or not. And you may or may not, well, you will not be in total control of that process. If, however, you apply the principles and practices of quantitative genetics, which were only discovered and developed in great detail at the very end of the 1800s, and developed more fully in the early part of the 1900s, so only in the last 100 years or so, if you use those to intensify the efficiency of the process, that's what I'm calling genetic improvement, okay? Now, for the process of genetic improvement, selective breeding is central. It's the process of taking the best-performing organisms and using them to produce the next generation. It's had a proven success rate in agriculture, and it is dependent on well-managed breeding programs. They depend on these quantitative genetics approaches, and that involves the estimation of a range of genetic parameters, heritabilities, and genetic correlations. I'm not going to go into the detail of those, but essentially heritability is a measure of whether you can make changes using genetic approaches or not. Genetic correlations tell you if you attempt to select for one character, what effects that might have on another important character. Another important measurement is called genetic by environment interactions, and that is a process where you look at whether selection in one environment in a population will have the same result in another environment, because it does not need to be so. And so these estimators here allow you to calculate the breeding value of the animals from which that you wish to use as your broodstock for the next generation. So you're really controlling the process of improving these animals. Now, that process has been improved in efficiency in recent years using molecular tools, as have a range of husbandry processes. By using samples from animals, you can identify their sex, and you can identify which parents give rise to which young by using these genetic markers. The top example here is shrimp, where the females always have two bands and the male always has one. This is an example of where you've got various individuals tested and they have bands from one parent and bands from another parent. And so you also use this process to look at gene expression changes through either in different tissues, in different environments, or through time. And here you can see an example of genes through time, and you can see this set of genes are switched on at this time, this set at another time. Some sets have got a very specific period in which they're expressed, and this provides you with a lot of information on the how organisms develop, what are the sorts of characters you might be able to influence, and so improve production. In this slide here, it's from human genetics because nobody in aquaculture has been able to spend this amount of money so far. But they look at related gene networks, and here there's something like several thousand genes being tracked, and the red ones have been expressed far more strongly in this environment, and the others have been reduced. So they're looking at the effect of when you change one gene, what do all the others in the network do? Now, the sorts of resources that are used to support these analyses are things called EST libraries. These are just relatively small fragments of DNA which are sequenced, and they provide information on potential markers, potential genes that could be of interest. And when you have other fragments of DNA arrayed on a chip, as here, you can use these or what are called transcriptomic approaches just to test for differences in gene expression in a variety of circumstances. These tell you about how the organism is operating genetically. And of course, the genome sequence itself provides a very strong platform of information. Now, the reason why in aquaculture you want to use these tools is effectively to involve them in marker-assisted selection. So it's easy to tell if an animal is big or small, but it's very difficult to tell whether it's resistant to a disease or not. And if you're selecting for egg size, you can't do that in males by looking at the animal. Males do not express eggs. But they may have genetic markers which indicate that they would be responsible for producing a larger egg. And so it's a way of being able to increase the efficiency of your selection and to make it more accurate, and ultimately to produce results faster. Now, I want to just, and as I said before, the selection of additional traits where you can't actually observe them or where they're very difficult to measure. Now, that can lead to a process called whole genome selection, which I'll talk about briefly later. I just want to show you some of these things for those individuals who don't look at this material a lot. What you do with a bunch of markers is you do a mating, screen the progeny and the parents, and from looking at the association of these markers, you'll see some are associated in groups. Here there are two. Each of these groups will be associated with a particular chromosome. And so your markers are arrayed here, and if you've measured some other characteristic, in this case sex, or whether it was growth, you can determine which of these markers are associated with the character of interest. In a greater analysis, what you can then do, taking these spider diagrams down here, you can look for the statistical association with the character you're interested in. And in this case, we have three characters, all of which are related to growth. This data happens to come from shrimp. And you can see here that I think this was something like weight, this was length, this was another measure of length. All of these indicate that on this particular chromosome, around this region, there was a gene or genes responsible for something like 30% of the variation in growth seen in that test population. But what I want to just tell you here is that this marker and this marker here, I believe, are these two. Now that looks pretty close here, but in actual fact, when you translate this marker to a real piece of DNA and a whole chromosome, you find that it's something like 3 million base pairs of gene sequence, which is something like 300 or 400 genes. So you might think you've been pretty smart getting all these markers. Then you actually find a tray of interest, but you've got something like 300 genes possible for a major effect. So it's only the beginning of the game. And you will realize later when we look at the uptake of these technologies why I'm making these points. So you get the statistical relationships of these markers, you look for characters of interest, and the importance of another set of resources are physical maps and large insert libraries. These are where you've got large sections of DNA which you can piece together to get genome sequence for the whole chromosome, and that way you're really beginning to get information on how the genetic material in your species of interest is structured and then how you can manipulate it most efficiently. Now, I said before that can lead to a process of whole genome selection. Now, the pedigree from SNP analysis using many of these markers, and the importance here is it has to be thousands, mean that selection is more accurate even if you don't measure the physical characteristics. And this can potentially save huge amounts of money by not having to make those measurements. The molecular data was more accurate than the paper trail. Aquaculture is nowhere close to doing this. Chromosome set manipulation involves taking whole chromosome sets and either increasing the number of them or only using material from one sex. So I won't go into the detail of it, but basically you can use only the female genes in a process called gonogenesis, only the male genes in a process called androgenesis. These processes can be used to create clonal lines and highly inbred lines. And you can change ploidy, and most of you will be familiar with increasing the number of sets to give you triploid organisms, which are very often grow faster or are sterile. And they're the characteristics you want in a production system at certain times. The processes can also be used to insert specific genes, and that direct process is the one that leads to the creation of GMOs. Now, I don't expect you to read this slide, but what we did was we went and looked at which of all these technologies were available for all of the species which are cultured. And apart from giving us a headache, the one thing I will note, ask you to note is just generally where you've got an organism that has some molecular marker resource, it very often has a range of them, and when it does, it also has a genetic map. So there are those species which have work done on them, and there are those species which have none. Also, this grouping is fish, and you'll see fish have a whole range of technologies which are generally not applied to either crustaceans or mollusks. So there's a bit of difference between groups. But let's look first at how many are domesticated. And you can see here, it's actually looking, in a sense, pretty good. Overall, there's about 40% of these organisms are apparently domesticated. When we now look at these genetic improvement technologies, and I've lumped them into those groups I made before, and basically you can see that of the animals responsible for 99% of production, animals and plants, you have something like 53, say a quarter to a half of all of those, excuse me, a quarter to a half of these species have some of those technologies developed for them. And indeed, when you look at the total of about 360 species, roughly that percentage halves, which means there's been a focus of activity, not unreasonably, on the more productive species. The genetic parameters I talked about generally indicate that you can select for a whole range of characters. The genetic correlations are variable, but they indicate characters related to size, weight, and growth generally have high correlations, but they're variable between other characters. They show that responses to selection reflect those heritabilities. There have been some very good responses to selection of 10 to 15% per generation. But on average, across all species and in production systems generally, genetic improvement programs provide something like 5% improvement per year or per generation. Genotype by environment interactions are rare. They appear to have been low in some of the key species tested. But when we have a deeper look at this, I will now summarize these slides very quickly. When we have a deeper look at this, you find that the EST libraries have anywhere from 1,000 to 10,000 samples. There's only one that I'm aware of that's got more than 100,000. Compare that to agricultural species where it's a million or more. MAPS usually have only about 500, of less than 500 markers. There's only one example where it's over 1,000. That's Atlantic salmon, rainbow trout, I'm sorry. Then compare that to agricultural species where it's greater than 10,000 and very often higher than that. The markers used to make the MAPS in aquaculture often use AFLPs, some microsatellites, but these can only be used in the test population. You can't actually use them for more extended analysis. So it's early days is the message. The density of markers are low. These QTLs, where you see a major effect, there's less than 10 in most populations for which, most species for which there have been estimates. The precision is poor, as I have described, and there's only one, to my knowledge, which is being used in a marker-assisted selection program to date. When we look at the other technologies, very briefly, triploidy has found use in particularly fish and mollusks. It's not used in crustaceans. It's used largely in salmonids for matters of sterility rather than improved growth, but it's had large application in the mollusk industry for not so much sterility but for better growth and condition. Gonogenesis and androgenesis has been used to help the formation of various breeding programs, in carp particularly, but there are only three clonal lines in finfish, despite a 30% of these animals in aquaculture having some of these technologies developed. Of GMOs, there's no GMOs, to my knowledge, for mollusks. There's been some work on shrimp, but the vast majority has been on fish. There are only two in extensive trials and one, as was discussed yesterday, close to regulatory approval. So when we look at breeding programs, there are few of significant scale. There's only about 10 to 12 finfish, three mollusk, and three crustaceans. And all of these have involved a mix of government, private sector, sometimes NGO involvement, and have required sustained investment. One can understand this because to have a breeding program, you actually need to routinely turn over each generation. You have to have considerable discipline to make all the measurements accurately, and that's rare. So you need an integrated rearing and production technology and good distribution networks for your products. So the two points I want to make here are relatively few species. All of them have involved a range of international exchange and collaboration, and that implies that we really need to have effective mechanisms for exchange and benefit sharing with respect to access to those genetic resources. One point I'm just going to make before I leave this slide is cod now has had extensive investment in it. It's looking very shaky at the moment, so despite a couple of excellent examples in Atlantic salmon and tilapia for how you can use a selective breeding program, and both of those have hugely increased production of those two species, cod has a fantastic family selection program, but they've still been using, for the industry at large, salmon feeds. They still haven't really got high survival in the larval process, so we don't know how this is going to go. And the industry's voted with its feet in that it's not growing them anymore. So even if you get all the sophisticated stuff right, the market has to be right, and you need to have your integrated rearing technologies. So the utilization of genetics in aquaculture about 20 years ago was less than 5%. Today it's more. But my problem in actually saying how much it is that there's a great difficulty in getting this information. Now, using the data that we collected from all those 360 species, the estimates we've come up with range from 38% to 73% of all production, which looks pretty good, but that's only if I assume that if there is a breeding program for our species, all its production is related to that breeding program. That is clearly not the case. So if we assume instead that it's perhaps 10% of the carps instead of 100% are produced by genetic improvement, you see it goes down to 7%. So the range of estimation is anywhere from 7 to 76% of finfish, depending on changing assumption for three carp species. So there is a huge need for more, for clearer information on genetic resources and how they're used within aquaculture. The upper limits of the estimations for mollusks are 15%, 67% for crustaceans, and 99% for seaweed, but that's because there's really only two species responsible for the vast majority of production. But more realistic estimates are far less than 10% for mollusks, about 45 for crustaceans, and I've said for finfish, I can't really tell. Now, briefly, wild genetic structures. The application of genetic markers to wild populations over the last 20 years has provided a huge amount of information, much of it previously unsuspected. There's high genetic variation in many species. It turns out that many widespread species are composed of several cryptic species. There's huge amounts of geographic variation in many species, even though they have larval lives and lifestyles that suggest that they disperse widely. So that means often that there's local adaptation. Now, in the last 10 years, the methods of analysis available to population genetics have improved immensely. And by using a different variety of markers, by using the genome information, which tells you which parts of the genome are selected and which are not, you can get a sense of whether the animals, the structure that they have in the wild is a function of their movement, a function of adaptation, a function of selection. You can work out the directions in which they've gone, and very often the three graphs on the slide show you that the directions of gene flow are at right angles to the main current directions in those oceans. So there's a lot of counterintuitive patterns emerging from that. In other words, there's a lot we need to yet understand about the structuring and evolution of wild populations. And that includes many aquaculture species. The application then of this evolutionary genetics, which is able to tell us who got where, when, and how, and whether they were adapted, is shown in some of these graphs where you can then track escapees and see how the gene frequencies change through time, so where they've gone. It allows you now to look at the adaptation within cultured populations to understand the recruitment, effective population size, and gene exchange. What they all show is variable effects of introduction, variable effects of restocking, and help understand the process of the evolution of stock and culture. The right-hand column shows you that 80% of these aquaculture species have some information on the wild genetic resource. Two slides. The number of species over the last 30 years or so has increased immensely. But the point I want to make here is that of the top 15 producing species over that period, there's only been about 20 species involved in that. So there's a huge increase in the number of species, but they don't appear to have made a huge impact on the overall worldwide production. And then finally, we can see here that when we look at this increase, change it to a log curve, you can see that although the increase in total cultured animals continues, those domesticated does not keep up with it. And while it is paralleled by genetic improvement, the numbers are less than 10% for the reasons I've given. They suggest something like 30 years for domestication and 60 years for genetic improvement. So, the responsible use and conservation of aquatic biodiversity for sustainable aquaculture requires, the use of efficient mechanisms for production with a focus on production, involving some careful consideration now of species choice, the requirement for integrated technologies and global cooperation, and the clarity of goal. The use of technologies to minimize environmental and genetic impact through containment, the reduction of gene exchange through perhaps sterility, and then, of course, aspects of conservation through restocking and gene banking, among others. Now, there's a series of potential recommendations here which we may put up later, but for the moment, what I'll do is close and ask the chairman to open discussion.
Thank you, John, for the very informative presentation. Actually, John promised me to be on time. Sorry. Anyway, quickly, I would like to call upon the panel members on stage. Dr. Devin Batley, Dr. Brian Davy, Dr. Ednas, and Dr. Thuy Nguyen. Okay, now we open the floor for discussion, and I would like to have questions or reflections from the members, and especially we would like to hear recommendations on these issues on responsible use of genetics, biodiversity for sustainable aquaculture. May I have hands up on these issues? Yes, please. As usual, state your name and where you come from.
No, just quickly, Matthias Halvard from FAO. I think it's very important that we have the recommendations up on the screen so that the audience is aware and can actually direct their interventions towards these.
Maybe, Dr. Matthias, you are also on stage? Because I... yeah, John didn't recognize. Please, yeah.
So, ladies and gentlemen, these are just some very general recommendations following the talk. Disagreements, changes, please correct us.
Any ideas, opinions from the floor? If not, maybe some of the panel members want to elaborate on these recommendations. Yes.
Maybe this is working. I was just wondering about... It's very interesting.
Your name and your...
Ramesh Pereira from Biosecurity Australia. I'm not involved in this field directly, but it was very interesting to me nonetheless. From the context of a lot of the technologies that you've described are, much more accessible to the commercial large-scale aquaculture sector. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were on... if some of these recommendations are actually adopted and, you know, in terms of selectively bred, a limited number of selectively bred species, then how that technology can be transferred to small-scale, the small-scale subsistence-like sector.
In fact, that is the question I was seeking to raise, because obviously it takes a lot to get a selective breeding program working. There have been many smaller selection programs started by individual companies or smaller groups or by aid programs, and after 2 or 3 years they've disappeared. So that is one of the fundamental questions, is can we sustain aquaculture, increase in aquaculture production over the next 30 years to triple its output simply by accessing more area to farm? I don't think so. Has it been achieved by, in the past, it's been achieved largely by improving management? Can we continue that process to the same extent? Everybody always points to the considerable advantage of using genetic improvement as absolutely demonstrated in agriculture and now in examples in aquaculture. But it's clear that it's not being applied to a considerable extent. So I'm asking the question more than anything else, just as you've done. Perhaps some others have suggestions to make.
Just to add to that, I was trying to get my colleague Eknath to talk about this, but he's shy at the moment. In terms of reaching small farmers, and particularly related to the GIF tilapia, there were experiments through a public-private partnership in the Philippines. This went for about a year and then has become defunct. But I think in terms of understanding what happened in that process, what were some of the problems and what could we learn from it, that's still to happen. And hopefully there will be more of these trials. And particularly I think what we need to do is accumulate some knowledge in terms of a process of how this transfer might work and build on some of the points that John has made. There isn't, as far as we know, anything documented about this Philippine case.
Okay, Dr. Sena.
Senator De Silva, Naka. I'm not sure, as I understand these recommendations, whether there is something embedded in this on access and benefit sharing. So I'm requesting the panel and this audience whether there should be a specific recommendation on access and benefit sharing of aquatic genetic resources, which has taken backstage when you compare to agricultural resources. And you might also mention that it's only last year that aquatic genetic resources came within the portfolio of the Genetic Commission for Food and Agriculture. Thank you.
Yeah, just a comment. Thank you, Professor De Silva. The FAO does have a Commission on Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture that works closely with the Department of Fisheries and the Convention on Biodiversity. And we convened a meeting last year where, based on work in the plant sector primarily, the access and benefit sharing regime is trying to be codified. Because, as John pointed out, the plants were domesticated 10,000 years ago through the work of individual farmers in centers of origin and moved from those centers several thousand years later and several thousand years ago. With aquatic animals, it's quite different. I think John showed that the areas of genetic improvement are far away from those centers of origin, and they've involved an extensive amount of private industry investment or international support, as in the case of the GIF tilapia. So the access and benefit sharing regimes for aquatic species are going to be much different than those regimes from plants, and that is the model that the international community is almost trying to force upon the aquatic sector, trying to give benefits back to traditional people that is appropriate for plants but not so appropriate with the improved shrimp, the improved salmon, the improved tilapia. So I think we're going to have to be extremely vigilant in watching this process to make sure that we don't get international laws or regulations or policies that are appropriate for plants that are not so appropriate with fish and crustaceans.
So that's exactly my point. So shouldn't there be some sort of recommendation made from this meeting which goes into plenary, whatever the panel recommends and the body, the audience agrees, to be careful or have a different mechanisms for that? We need to evolve a different set of guidelines and mechanisms for access and benefit sharing of aquatic genetic resources.
Yeah, let me just, John's going to respond. Let me say one thing. The other important part is that a lot of aquaculture production is based on the sharing and the transfer of alien species and alien genotypes. And we have to make sure that this right to responsibly use alien species is not taken away from the aquaculture sector. And maybe something like that could... We'll try to draft something, and on the last day, Fatima will present the results of this discussion, and you'll have another chance to fine-tune the recommendation. And John?
Yes. Saina, I think you've put your finger on it, in that I think the sort of comment we might sensibly make from this meeting is that that we note the nature of the development, but we also note that already the benefits are shared widely in many instances, and that any regime involving the assessment of benefit sharing should actually be quite flexible, with perhaps a suggestion of the items that should be considered, but the decision-making would be between the parties involved. Something of that general nature. I don't know how the audience feels about that sort of recommendation.
Okay.
Thank you. I've been asked to make a comment on the issue of aquatic genetic resources and the international context. And in that regard, I just wanted to say that the attention to the aquatic genetic resources is increasing. And within the international context, it's the Commission on Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture that has the overall responsibility. And this commission expanded its mandate in 1995 to now deal also with aquatic genetic resources. And we're now working with this commission towards a state of the world. And there is a multi-year program of work that is set to deal with this issue over the next 10 years or so. So I thought it's important to add this to the discussion. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I just can take one more question from the gentleman there, I think. We are running out of time. Maybe one more? Okay, two more. Last two. All right.
Sharif Sadek from Aquaculture Consultant Office.
Yeah, actually, never mind. Go.
Okay.
Next.
Okay. I'm wondering if we need a bank gene worldwide. Simply, this is the questions. Do we need a bank gene worldwide? I know some countries are keeping bank genes, but what is the responsibility of each country and worldwide? Thank you.
Okay. I didn't touch as much on this, but there are some technologies for gene banks, but they are not simple in the case of most aquatic species, at least the animals. You can't simply put things in a seed packet and hide them in a mountain in Norway. So most of it involves deep freezing and other processes. So should there be gene banks? Yes, I think there should be. Who's going to find the money is one issue. The other is, I really think we also should assist the process of preserving, well, I hate the word preserving, of allowing the continuance of wild genetic resources through conservation areas and other things. But I think gene banking and also the maintenance of important domesticated lines is also important to achieve. The question is going to be, how do you find the resources to do it? One point I'll make here is that in agriculture there are several thousand varieties and lines available. In aquaculture, as far as we know, there's less than 100. But when I say that, there's only two papers that I could see, or two areas where people are actually doing that. Lack of information again. So the answer is yes. And there's cryogenic capability to do that for a number of species, but there's a bit of technical development, and we need to work out how to do it.
Just a quick follow-up. You have to keep in mind that, just as John said, the low temperature and the cryopreserved gene bank, we can only conserve half of the genetic resources. We can only do sperm. It's not genderly balanced at all, so it's not really...
It's milk, not sperm.
It's milk, right? Thanks, Agnath. The other issue is there's live gene banks and aquarium breeding centers, as in the Czech Republic and Hungary, and with the gift fish. And these are even more expensive to maintain. But as far as maintaining the entire genome or selectively improved line, that's all we have right now.
Okay, I can take one more question there, and last one, Barry. Barry, okay.
Thanks for a nice presentation. Daniel Lemos from the University of São Paulo, Brazil. I'd like to hear from panel members on their feelings on current advance and perspective on combining studies between nutrition and genetic improvement as well as nutrigenomics.
At the moment in aquaculture, nutrition and genetic research, there's some institution and research going on combining nutrition and genetics in terms of gene expression. For example, nutritional ingredients add in the feed, how to turn on the gene at a certain time, at certain of developments. So basically, with the development of technology, it's going very fast. It goes such a really fast pace. And the tool in bioinformatics also help to assist to integrate the development of genetics and integrate it to nutritional research. And there are books being published on something called nutritional genomics. And if you would like to have a read, and you know, there are research going on, and there's great potential in terms of genes and environment study that are the nutrition.
Okay, Barry, last one. Then we have to move on to the next presentation.
Costa Pierce from the University of Rhode Island. In the talk was very good on the sort of the very technical sides of the genetic development of domestication. I'm very concerned about the conservation side of this. When you appear in conservation ecology or biology society meetings, our friends in marine fisheries in particular are extremely concerned about, okay, maybe only 25 to 50% of our work is on the domestication. They're concerned that not only are those species being released to the marine environment particularly, but they're also concerned about the ones that are not domesticated, that we're releasing regularly to the marine environment. So I would encourage, well, first of all, I'd like the comments of the panel about that, but there's really nothing in the recommendations right now that is clearly reviewed from the aquaculture science portfolio, not only on the risk assessment, but really what is the hard science that is available showing what kinds of impacts that we've had from both the domesticated and non-domesticated species, particularly on the marine environment and in reference to marine fisheries. Thank you.
A very good point. One I'm conscious that I didn't go into in detail. And indeed, it's one of the reasons why I think that we have to be more focused on how we develop genetic improvement programs, but more particularly, how we contain that material. Now, the issue here is that a lot of aquaculture, as you say, uses either wild broodstock or, has fry, which is then released. I mean, there's restocking programs and so on. And, Devin, you might wish to talk about that later, sort of capture the culture-based fisheries. The potential impact of all of those activities is actually far greater than contained genetic improvement systems. There has been clear evidence to date, particularly in some salmonid populations, of huge effect of continued and sustained release of young to the wild. Some of that was not actually for aquaculture, but for the sustenance of the wild population. But yes, there have been clear demonstrations of major effects on not just the frequency of the genes, but that the fact that those organisms do not appear to be as well adapted to the wild. Now, in fact, that in one sense is good news, because if it means that aquaculture populations aren't going to do too well in the wild if they escape. But it does mean that if you're using an aquaculture process to provide fish to sustain a fishery, or to restock, you have to think very carefully how you do that. So I think perhaps, I mean, are you asking that there be a recommendation of some form in relation to closing life cycles and managing the genetics of that process within aquaculture? Is that...
If I can very quickly, one of the risk assessment strategies that we think is appropriate is the precautionary approach. And this should be science-based, and FAO has defined what we think a precautionary approach could be. And key in that approach is developing target and limit reference points that are based on science that you can start collecting data for, whether it's gene flow, changes in heterozygosity, changes in spawning time. You identify those parameters that are science-based, and you tell industry, these are the targets that you're going to avoid or you're trying to achieve. If you can't avoid them, you got to change. If you achieve them, we let you continue. We use the scientific process to reduce the uncertainty and move forward.
Okay, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We have to move on. So before that, on behalf of the organizing committee, we would like to thank Dr. John Benzi as the panel expert and all the panel members and all the questions and ideas from the audience to make this session a lively one. Thank you.